Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and it's always fantastic to be joining you. We're actually recording in the middle of the day. Usually we record at 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock my time, so it's a little earlier than usual, but that's actually good. I'm actually awake and bushy-tailed for a change. So, and that laugh you hear is our friend and co-host Sam Bradley. Sam's on a cell phone with us today because she isn't quite set up in her new digs. She just moved to a new place. So, hey, Sam.
Hey, Jamie. Yes, a new definition of disaster called moving. I think the worst of it was over in terms of just getting everything in here, but now I've got to find stuff, and that's proving to be interesting. But I'm in a 1924 Victorian farmhouse in the middle of farm country in Colorado, so it'll be kind of an interesting experience. So I'll let you know how that works as it goes along. So we have Dr. Joe Hawley with us today, our favorite Dr. Joe, who's brought in someone he's been interacting with for quite a long time. So I'm going to kind of let him run with that. Well, how are things with you, Joe?
Well, hi, guys. It's good to talk to you again. Things are great. It's a beautiful springtime here in Memphis. So, it's 75 and sunny and beautiful today. And you're right. I'm really pleased to have a friend of mine on, a fellow Eagle, I guess is the right way to say that, a longtime EMS medical director, Neil Richmond. Neil, it's really great to have you on with us. Thanks so much for being here. If you don't mind, maybe just kind of tell us about your EMS and disaster medicine journey from way back to fairly recent.
Okay. Well, hey, thanks, Joe. It's really my great privilege and pleasure to be here with all of you today. Thanks for the opportunity. So I guess my long, sad story begins back in the 90s in New York City. I was a practicing emergency doc and, directing a residency program. And then I joined the I'd been interacting with EMS for quite a while throughout my training and then attending hood. And then I joined the New York City Fire Department in EMS the year that the two officially merged. So it's a very interesting period and got to go through the growing pains of a very large fire system absorbing a previously independent, essentially third service emergency medical service system, which is also very large. And during that time, I was there through about 2004, and certainly New York has enough stuff going on during that time. Also worked on the USAR team and was deployed to, a couple of disaster-type events. And after that, I moved to Louisville, Kentucky, where it was starting sort of a bit of poetic irony, so to speak, in that they had a previous one side fire-based EMS system and a freestanding county system. They essentially created a new city at that point, the 16th largest city in the country, by merging the county and the city into one. And anyhow, they had the opportunity to rethink their sort of somewhat fragmented system and decided to create a brand new unified third service freestanding EMS system. So I came in there to be the overall system director as well as the medical director. So it was an unusual opportunity for a physician that probably a handful of us in this country have had the chance to do. And that, again, came with all sorts of challenges. And then most recently, I've transplanted myself to Fort Worth, Texas, and had the privilege of doing medical direction for the entire MedStar system. So it's a public utility model, somewhat a third service regulated by the government, and also do medical direction for the 15 surrounding cities and fire departments that provide first response. So that's the general picture, and I guess we can bounce off that a little bit.
Well, that's awesome.
We could do several podcasts with you, Neil, just the number of adventures that you've already had. But it sounds like we're going to talk about something that some people might think there's an obvious answer to, but I know there's not. And that's, looking at MCIs and looking at disasters and how do you define the difference? So that's going to be fascinating. And Joe, I'm going to let you run with it. And you and Neil can just go and see what we come up with.
Well, thanks, Sam. So this conversation started for Neil and I think at one of the meetings that we were both at, and we're sort of having a conversation around disaster medicine, no shock there for me, certainly. But, you know, MCIs as well, and kind of the similarities and differences between those entities. And then that sort of branched off into everything from the challenges at a medical director level of overseeing a system in both those situations. So, you know, I think maybe we just sort of start with some of that. And you know, Neil, we'd love to hear your take on kind of the issues you see with the differences between those two entities, an MCI and a disaster, and what kind of things sort of spring to mind for you that become real challenges for not only the medical director level, but for providers and leadership in those situations.
Yeah. So, yeah, I can't remember, Joe, if we got into this conversation, was it after the third or fourth bourbon? And sorry, I can't take responsibility for anything we made. Okay. So, yeah, and I don't want to disappoint your listenership, but I think the way this came about, again, we were talking about MCIs and disasters. And, I, you know, we're in this field where clearly we're always very focused on it. And I don't use the word to be sarcastic, but, you know, we do all sort of like the stuff about emergency care that's a bit sexy, you know, where, you know, it's big stuff, right? Everybody is waiting for the big job. And some of us have had the opportunity to be on the big job or a big job. And to be honest, I'm much less interested in that. Like, it does happen. You know, you saw the recent events in Orlando, and we just had something, you know, in St. Petersburg the other day. I mean, it happens all over the world. And the reality of all that stuff, as we know, is most of those patients end up not coming in by EMS. Typically, people are often who are in the epicenter of those disasters are going to die. And there's a small number of people who really get taken to hospitals and or treated. And definitely we help some. But I think in my mind, what's come to me in the last 20-something years of doing this, the big job is not that. The big job is what happens every day in this country in all of our systems. So what I'm getting at is, I think if you were to look at what we would call the bad cases or the untoward results in every major, minor system in this country and add them up every day, we essentially have an MCI each and every day of the year. And just to be more specific, what I'm talking about is really basic sort of stuff where, for example, airway management, you know, how many patients get transported to the hospital with unrecognized, misplaced advanced airways, for example. How many patients, you know, we take it for granted when we see someone in cardiac arrest, that of course, if they were in defib, they got shocked. But what I've learned after looking at this for years, unless you really look at it in the sense of have the software and the tools to analyze what's going on the scene, you maybe don't realize that there's quite a number of cases in your system of unrecognized or untreated ventricular fibrillation. So I can go on and on, and I'll be glad to if you like. But as I said, I'm much more interested in what happens day to day, what we think is always working swell, cases that would never really come to our attention as a sentinel event or a quality assurance type problem. You know, if you read the patient care report, everything looks pretty good, and you may have really skilled, compassionate, well-educated, trained, experienced providers, but things go wrong. And I think in many ways, we as a discipline could be doing much better than we're currently doing. And I'm very interested in the why. Why is it the patients are not fully stabilized and end up dying in the back of the truck on the way to the hospital? And we typically think that someone like that was just dying. We caught them on that. They're straddling the edge of life and death, and it's a very sad case they die. But I can't tell you how many countless cases we've had the opportunity to evaluate, and you realize that people who die in the back of the truck might not have had to do that if everything else had been in order. And the question is, why is everything not in order? So I'll leave it at that just to sort of light the match to the fuse, and we'll see where it goes.
Well, I think you should have. Go ahead, Sam.
No, I was just going to say, wow, there could be a lot of potential answers to that question. But you know, now that we have the ability to do research, is that really giving us anything back? I mean, you and Joe work in two separate systems, but are you getting anything that really helps answer that question through the data?
Yes.
Being returned?
Yeah, and I think this gets to the crux question of what one does, you know, in an office of, let's say, medical direction and oversight, whether it's the medical director or the paramedics or EMTs who work together, how do you get at this? And I think typically our efforts have been on, you know, reviewing charts or something like that. You know, we look for boxes being checked off, and typically our system leadership is very focused on process and response times and how many people show up on the scene and what kind of people and all that kind of stuff and how long does it take to get to the hospital. But I think if you start to expend your energy and what I would consider really meaningful QA. So for example, it's one of my pet, I guess, peeves, so to speak. But so we've spent a great deal of time looking at every single one of our advanced airways. And the way we look at it is not whether somebody checks off on a box that they got the tube in one attempt or two attempts, which is what used to happen here for years. We'd get reported on at the oversight meetings, you know, this was our percentage of subjectively, you know, what the crew members thought had happened. So we have, for example, continuous end tidal waveform capnography, which measures the CO2 that comes out of the tube, whether that's a supraglottic tube, a blind insertion device like a King Airway or a combi tube or something like that, or an actual endotracheal tube, which the patient has been intubated with. And this is where you see it. I mean, we see quite a number of cases where someone is being transported to the hospital and they have an absolutely flatline CO2. So why is that? I mean, nobody's stupid. Nobody's badly intentioned, but there's some educational things that go on. So, for example, when we have asked providers, and it's not just my current system, it's other systems I've been in, it's the same kind of story, you know, they'll typically say, well, I know the tube's in because I auscultated and I listened over the lungs and I listened over the stomach and everything seems to be okay. So what must be happening is that CO2 detector on the device is clogged, typically by some secretions or something like that. So they leave the tube in. But the reality is, if you really understand their technology, is a flatline CO2 means that the tube is not placed correctly. Bottom line, you know, that is the answer to the question. The tube needs to come out. So again, many, many, many systems, including the largest systems in this country, don't even have the capability to measure it. If they do have the capability to measure it, it's not clear whether paramedics and, you know, EMTs really understand necessarily what they're looking at or how often they really do look at it and use it to guide their management. And finally, do they have in the background a Office of Medical Direction and Oversight that anybody after the fact looks at those? So let me just be more to the point. So in the last bunch of years, many of our systems had gone to these blind insertion airway devices, right? Like King tubes or whatever it happens to be, or iGels or, you know, and they're all good devices, but they've been to some extent billed as, you know, your 6-year-old daughter could put one in. I mean, you know, anybody can pretty much do it. And the reason they came about is that there was some literature that had come out showing that there's a substantial number of unrecognized misplaced tubes. Our dear friend and colleague Sal Silvestri, who recently died, had done some of the early work on this. There have been at least a number of papers, and there was a meta-analysis done in pre-hospital emergency care that looked at this problem. So we did it because of that. We also did it because people began to realize that basically screwing around with tubes during cardiac arrest was wasting time in terms of pulling people off the chest, and the thing that mattered the most was doing CPR and shocking patients who were in ventricular fibrillation. So, again, to be very explicit about that, all we did here is we looked at about a year's worth of our supraglottic airways. And the reality is that close to, I think it was about 19% of our King tubes were not in when the provider, I hate to use that word, but when the EMT or paramedic thought they were in. And again, what was checked off on the PCR did not equate with what we actually saw in the CO2. So it's one thing to say, look, the tubes weren't in. We didn't have a wave tracing to show us that they were pushing out CO2, meaning the tube was in the right place. But really, to add insult to injury, up to close to 20% of tubes that weren't in, about 15% were unrecognized. And here's the reality. I mean, I hate hanging out dirty laundry, but, you know, by all accounts, I work in a great system. I think it is a great system. I think we've got really great providers. But I don't know that we have previously given our personnel the tools, the education, the training, and the follow-up by really evaluating this stuff after the fact to know what was going on. So we've intervened on it, and we've been spending more time in training, and it's not perfect, but I promise you those numbers are a whole lot better now. Typically, when a provider says the tube is in, getting much closer to 100% of the time, we know that the tube is in. But I promise you that if you're a system that has not given your folks the tools to do that, and they understand how to do it, and you don't evaluate it and fix whatever problems you see, then the sad news is you're transporting a lot of people with tubes that aren't in, which is why bother transporting, because they're not going to live by the time they get to the hospital.
Yeah, well, you're making some valid points for me, because I, you know, was in the field for many years, and right now I do QI for a BLS fire department that uses King tubes. And what they do is the BLS provider, the firefighter, will put the tube down, but then when the ALS agency gets there, they put them on capnography and, of course, on a monitor and all the other things. And it's from at that point, confirmation, CO2 detector, you know, whatever else they're going to use to confirm that the tube is good, and then they take responsibility from that point on. So far, it seems to have worked. I don't recall actually getting any feedback on a bad tube. So that part seems to be working. But what do you think about BLS providers using it? Do you think there's any real difference in effectiveness?
So I'm good with both sides using it, but I'll give you an example of what just happened here. Was of our 15 fire systems that were, most of them were BLS level, two that were functioning at a medic level, have the ability to put in King tubes. And with our new protocols, we've eliminated that to the extent that you're welcome to put in a King tube, but only when you have waveform capnography available to you at the scene, meaning you either have to have a cardiac monitor, which unfortunately many first responders don't have because they're using AEDs, and thus they don't have the CO2 monitoring capability. Or if an ambulance shows up on scene and the device is there, then we're fine with an EMT or paramedic placing it in, but it cannot be utilized in the absence of CO2. And again, I'll take it a step further and say that if you look at, you know, the basic tool that EMTs have lived by for years of bag valve mask ventilation, when you take a careful look at how that's done at the scene and what are these people's saturations and CO2s, which admittedly is a little bit difficult to measure with a BVM, it's the same problem. I mean, I think, to be honest, managing a BVM is probably harder than placing an endotracheal tube, especially in the kinds of patients we see. So again, we're good with it, but whatever airway. And now our mandate is that if you have anything above and beyond, let's say a 2-liter nasal cannula on the face of a patient to deliver oxygenation, there has to be CO2 capability in addition to the fact that we get an upload of your SpO2 and vitals and all the other stuff. You know, the other thing that we're also looking at is, so, you know, you can have a tube that goes in. So let's say, and it's successful, you know, the CO2 shows that, you know, they're getting something back and the tube is in and everybody says, yay, that's great, we got a tube. But again, what's very interesting is, and if you look at, you know, all the old rules about this, right, how many attempts you're allowed, I don't honestly care how many attempts it takes. I'm being a little exaggerating, but I mean, obviously I don't want somebody trying 25 times. But, you know, it happens even in the emergency room. They have a very complicated airway, and let's say it takes us 3 tries. But if during those 3 tries, the patient's blood pressure and pulse and oxygen saturation and CO2 were all where they basically needed to be, and nobody got their tongue cut and broke their teeth and, you know, all the, or they aspirated, then that's no problem if it took 2, you know, 3 tries. On the other hand, if you make 1 attempt, and during that attempt, the patient Brady's down to a rate of 20 and their blood pressure goes through the floor, you know, for 8 minutes and they have no saturation, no CO2, then great, I guess they got the tube after 8 minutes, but the damage has been done. So the point is, I think, you know, again, we don't drive trucks or use fire engines that don't have pressure gauges and speedometers and some sort of accounting. And I think if we don't give that to our people, we're doing them a great disservice.
Oh, really good points. Joe, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I was just thinking as Neil was speaking there that, you know, I've seen exactly the same issues. I've even reviewed in the last 6 months a couple of EMS lawsuits that are exactly on this issue. And what I see very consistently is medics primarily, since these are usually advanced airway related issues, who don't have as thorough an understanding of the value of end-tidal CO2, who seem to be very good about being able to tell me what a normal end-tidal CO2 number ought to be, but no concept that that number is really irrelevant until you know that the waveform is telling you that the tube is in the right spot before you can even interpret that number. And, you know, that same perspective on issues related to BLS providers with things as simple as bag valve mask and what a challenging thing that is to do well, and how important the subtleties there of doing that well are. You know, all of these airway management techniques are I won't say difficult, but have an awful lot of really important subtleties to them that I think many folks don't appreciate. Neil, I agree 100%, 110% with your comments related to, you know, oversight and that sort of stuff. I'm curious to know sort of what your take is on why are we having this struggle? You would think that someone who is doing a life-altering intervention on a patient would voraciously take in every piece of information they could possibly gain to ensure that they're doing it right and to improve their own skills and et cetera. Yet we don't seem to have that.
Yeah, well, and I want to be clear. Like, I don't want to take a shot at all the people who break their backs and 911 and other kinds of EMS systems to do this work. I think our people are across the board smart and motivated and interested, and they care about what's going on. I mean, there's always an element of, you know, it's nice to say that, but a lot of our people feel sort of beat up, right? You know, running around a lot, sure. Not having downtime, and, you know, lots of you know, mechanical sort of, you know, patient care report stuff to do that makes, you know, it's like for us in the ER, it's the same thing, you know, throwing out papers all the time. So I get all that. I think the problem is, and I second everything you just said a moment ago, but again, I think no one's going to know this until someone takes a look at it. So saying, well, by God, why haven't you guys done this? I put the onus on us, on the offices and medical direction and oversight, and on the leadership that, you know, drives our systems, that you've got to have. We talk about QA, and, you know, in a lot of systems, that means that the soups, you know, look at charts at the end of, you know, the day, and they read, you know, 5% of the charts or something. Well, I don't think that's QA. I think QA is you've got to have, you know, the software that allows you to look at these runs in almost real time, if not, you know, the next day, and brings the people in and shows them and then goes over in some kind of sim or mannequin setting, make sure that somebody knows how to use it. I mean, I don't think there's anything, like I said, I think I've been really good systems. I don't have something wrong with the providers, but I think like any of us, we need the tools to do it well. The flip side of that is that I think, you know, our systems have been for, it's like over a generation now of chasing ridiculous stuff, you know. You know, I just had, you know, recently I got a chance to read a so-called RFP for all those, you know, that so-called request for proposal about some system that's, you know, putting out for contract, you know, an EMS system. And again, if you read the requirements, you know, all the bidders, the people that want to come in and look to provide ambulance service, it's the same stuff. It's like, well, you got to get to the scene in X number of minutes. And you have to, even better than that, they have a rule that, you know, the most critical patients, you can only spend 10 minutes on the scene. And we've been doing exactly the, I mean, to me, that like absolutely crystallizes what's wrong with our field. You want the system that's going to guarantee that your providers spend no more than 10 minutes on the scene. So now you get there and you got someone who's in pulmonary edema or, you know, is septic and can barely breathe and is, you know, unstable. And by God, you know, we're going to take 10 minutes to get them packaged and into the truck and get them off, at which point the 10 minutes they had left to live are now taken away from them and from you. So we're very operationally based. I think over the last 20 years, we've become more and more operationally based. And unfortunately, our immediate leaderships and our city leaderships and our state leaderships, you know, are very focused on this idea of speed. Or, you know, if you look at some of the guidelines, let's say in the NFPA, which has lots of great things, you know, there's requirements for how many paramedics and how many EMTs you need on scene. I mean, I don't think it's about numbers and I don't think it's about time. We try to ask our providers, like, you have a critical patient, you better not be off the scene in 10 minutes. You probably shouldn't be off the scene in 20 minutes. And what I'll say is, you know, from most of our QA, when we see not just difficulties with airways, but I promise you, there's quite a number of unrecognized and untreated, you know, lethal cardiac arrhythmias like ventricular fibrillation. We see patients who, let's say, had very poor oxygen saturations and poor breathing on scene. And again, by the time they get into the truck, none of that has exactly been fixed. And we're pushing. We're telling everybody to rush, 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 as opposed to, you know, there's no reason to bring a dead patient to the emergency room. Like, you need to spend the time on scene and stabilize. And again, turning that the other way a little bit, I think the one problem, when we've talked to our folks about, like, well, why didn't you get their SATs up? Or why wasn't the BVM adequate? Or why didn't you get the tube in? And really, you do get this. Or what about all these runs of ventricular fibrillation that weren't shocked? And you just get this sense there's a tremendous amount of distraction, you know, or almost, I don't know what the right word is. I hate to say it, but, you know, sort of a panic element. I got really, really sick. The first responders, people with families screaming, the dogs barking, everybody's pushing us to get off the scene. And I want to get into the truck where everything's controlled and clean and neat. But again, we all know the really sad, tragic truth is that, you know, I mean, most of our patients, right, could take a taxi to the hospital. But we have something in the range of 10% or maybe a little less that by the time they call 911, they're pretty much dying. And if you take those few minutes and basically futz around and drag someone to the truck, it's over. And all that stuff, you know, I've told even, you know, some of our first responders, you know, they were like, oh, the room was crowded and the family was there. It's like, you know, you could basically throw all the furniture out the window, whatever you got to do to get that CPR going, because you're not doing the patient a lot of good by strapping him to a stretcher and doing crappy CPR and airway management down two flights of stairs, getting into the truck by the time you get everything hooked up, and then speeding to the hospital.
And we're going to break this episode into two parts, like we do sometimes here on the Disaster Podcast. And so we're going to be picking back up with Dr. Neil Richmond and Joe Holly and Sam Bradley next week on the show, where we will be continuing our discussion on really identifying the real MCIs that we are missing in our system. And I hope you've already garnered an understanding of what that means. We're going to be digging into a little bit more about how to fix these, some of these issues, and what it really means to do good, high-quality QA, quality assurance, in your system, and as an individual, perhaps as well. So come back next week for that. We do want to make sure we thank Paragon Medical Education Group. The whole team over there, Dr. Joe Holly and Jim Logan and the rest of them, do amazing things with experiential training and bring to a system, a type of training that you're probably not used to in anything you've ever done before, unless you've done something with Paragon in the past. So check them out over at ParagonMedicalGroup.com. I can't highly recommend them enough. You really need to check out what they're doing. There's a great video that kind of introduces you to the type of training they do and the things they work on. See what they can do to bring your system up to par with understanding what needs to be done in a disaster that might strike your community. And you can find them at ParagonMedicalGroups.com, MedicalGroup.com. You can find them at Paragon Medical Education Group on Facebook, Paragon Med EDU on Twitter, and of course, there's links in the Disaster Podcast site at DisasterPodcast.com on every episode. But definitely check them out and thank them for supporting the show. That's it for me, and speaking on behalf of Dr. Joe Holland, Sam Bradley, and our guest, Dr. Neil Richmond, I'm going to go ahead and remind you that, you know, even in our ordinary systems, when we don't understand what a disaster it is, sometimes the way we manage regular patients, that disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.